You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, July 14th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Saqib Bhatti, writing in the Jacobin on the Detroit bankruptcy, whether Chicago will be next. Also on the program today, for members only, will be John Perkins, author of The Economic Hitman, from the Deep Archives. This is for the members only, folks. The DCARP archives in November of 2004. Let's go to our chief Deep Archive curator, Noah, who also happens to be our intern, as to why we're going to be playing this Deep Archive. This is all in your hands. You're the chief executive of the Deep Archive for this week.
Yeah, well, kind of this winter, I was writing a paper on TARP, and I'm really late to the game. And when this book came out, I think I was 8, but I read it over the first time this winter, and it was just so shocking.
Whoa, wait. When this book came out, you were how much?
I was probably 8.
8 years old?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, if this is 2004, I was 8.
So when I did this interview, you were 8. Years old.
Yes.
Jesus Christ. Seriously?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I forgot what we were talking about. I think I'm feeling faint. You were 8 when we did this interview?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, my God. So you just finished writing, you said something, the last thing I remember you saying was you wrote a piece about TARP, and then I heard you were 8, and then I just passed out.
Yeah, I was writing a paper on TARP and kind of into the whole, like, disgusting economic policies vibe, and had this on my bookshelf for a long time and meant to read it. And so coming back from Portland to Austin for winter break, I read it, and it was really, really good and really just kind of scary.
You know, it was actually... And you may not even be aware of this, because I don't know if you've heard the interview I did with Saqib Bhatti. Now, I should remind people we are on vacation, so obviously this is pre-taped. But most people listen to it as a podcast anyway, so it's always pre-taped. But this dynamic with Detroit is – there is a similar dynamic here. And there's a dynamic that runs in so much of this where it's basically – you get municipalities, nations to, I mean, I think at some level we saw this was also with, you know, sort of with Greece. I mean, this dynamic where you feed them loans and then, you know, none of which is sustainable. And everybody knows that. And then you've basically got the power dynamic. I mean, this is basically the mafia, right? I mean, I think at the time that this came out on The Sopranos, Tony Soprano had lent money to the guy who owned the sporting goods store. And he lost the money, and then Tony owned the sporting goods store, and that was basically it. All right, well, then good choice, Chief Curator.
Well, thank you.
Chief Curator, who was 8 years old when this thing was released. Oh, my God. All right, folks. So enjoy today's program. We'll have another show tomorrow on with another member's deep archive that I think we actually didn't do until Noah was nine. So, boy, my day's been ruined. But enjoy this interview, folks. Later in the week, we're going to be hearing that story of the Fort Dix Five. Unbelievable piece from The Intercept. And then Scott Timberg on his book, Culture Crash.
How old were you when the Fort Dix Five story came out? No, I'm just joking. Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right. Matt, why don't you just get back? The baby's crying. Go ahead. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Saka Bhatti. He is the director of the Refund America Project and a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He is writing in These Times magazine on why Chicago won't go bankrupt and Detroit didn't have to. Welcome to the program, Saka.
Hi, how are you doing?
So I'm well, thank you. So let's jump right in here. Give us just a sense of when we say that Detroit went bankrupt. Give us a sense of what that means, because bankruptcy for a city, as you write, is not bankruptcy that as a business might experience it or an individual might experience it.
Absolutely. Municipal bankruptcy simply means that you're unable to pay your debts as they come due. And so basically it means that you have bills piled up, you can't pay them, and that means you're insolvent. If you're insolvent, then in 24 states, you have the ability to file bankruptcy under Chapter 9 of the Bankruptcy Code. It's not just a question of your debts are more than your assets, which is often, in a corporate sense, that's one of the key things that we're often looking at when we talk about insolvency, that if you have way too much debt, that means you're bankrupt. With a municipality, it really is, insolvency is really a question of whether or not you can pay your bills as they come due. And then if you are insolvent, then if your state authorizes it, then you can file bankruptcy to discharge some of that debt or restructure it.
So in other words, in a corporate situation, you have assets in the form of your factories, in the form of maybe receipts due, et cetera, et cetera, and you can sell those off to pay your creditors. If you don't have enough assets to sell off, that's when you're bankrupt. But a city, well, I mean, theoretically, right? We saw Detroit, they were going to sell off their museum, their art museum, but a city has to come back and function, right? There's no, I guess, Chapter 7 in the context of a city where the company goes away forever.
Right, that's exactly right. The idea is not that you're liquidating a city. As you mentioned, there are some assets that they might try to sell off, but the idea is not that you sell the entire city off, right? When, like, Circuit City goes under, the idea really is that you can sell off absolutely everything and Circuit City, where there's a win, does not exist anymore. That's not the case with a city, because the city has to go on existing. People still live there. They still need services. And so that's why when you're actually trying to figure out a bankruptcy plan, really one of the key things ends up being not, you know, can you sell off everything to pay off your debts right now, but rather what can you do to make it so that you can actually pay your bills as they come due. And so typically that ends up being either, you know, cutting some expenses or raising your revenue are the two things that you need to do. In a bankruptcy, the bankruptcy judge cannot require a city to raise new taxes. And so that's why often in a bankruptcy, the conversation ends up revolving around what can you cut.
All right, and so when you write that Detroit's bankruptcy was not born out of financial necessity and was not a foregone conclusion, it was a political decision made by state officials, apply that to what we've just talked about.
Sure. I mean, the reality is that in Detroit, even though the number that was often thrown out by the emergency manager was that the city had $18 billion in debt, that number didn't actually matter for the purpose of the bankruptcy itself. What the bankruptcy really needed to address was a $198 million shortfall, which, you know, is 1% of the $18 billion number. It's a fraction of that, right? So, and in the case of Detroit, the thing, I mean, Detroit, let's be clear, it has lots of structural issues, paramount among them the fact that its population had declined 60% from its height. The city is, you know, very, it has a lot of sprawl. It's very spread out, and it is sort of difficult with this with the shrinking tax base to actually service that. So there are some structural issues, but the immediate issue that actually triggered the bankruptcy was this $198 million shortfall. And the reality is that there are a number of different ways that that the state could have actually helped the city to deal with that shortfall. One of the most immediate things.
Excuse me for one second. Before we get to how we would deal with the shortfall, let's just tease this out. So they have $18 billion worth of debt, but this debt is not due, right? People are not expecting, people aren't sitting there saying, you got 30 days to pay this $18 billion. Their operating expenses were $198, per 30 days or whatever it was. They could not pay off their operating expenses. They still could carry their debt.
Right, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of like a mortgage. Like, you might have a $200,000 mortgage, but that doesn't mean you're bankrupt if you can't pay that today. In fact, that's the whole point of a mortgage, is that you can pay it off over time. And so similarly for the city of Detroit, $18 billion, it's not like they had to pay there right away. And the other thing that's actually important about Detroit is that the $18 billion number itself was inflated. It was inflated to sort of make the situation seem more dire than it was, because it included the debt of things like the water department, which actually is not the same as the debt of the city because of the way the finances are done over there. And so $6 billion of the debt that was part of the $18 billion was the water department, which is not actually their debt in terms of arriving at the pension.
Because they may have basically issued bonds or gotten loans on a different set of books.
Exactly, because the water department actually serves all of southeastern Michigan. It's about 40% of the population of the state of Michigan is serviced by the water department. It's administered by the city, but it actually serves several counties. And the way that those bonds are paid back is through people's water bills. And so the city's finances actually do not directly affect those bonds, because that debt is actually paid by the water bills from people all across southeastern Michigan.
I'm teasing this out just because I also want people to see the parallels with when we have discussions about national debt and whatnot. Now, it's obviously not the same, because Detroit and Michigan don't have the ability to print their own currency. But the inclusion of that water department debt in the greater debt of Detroit is the analogy would be to say, like, we have this unfunded liability in Social Security 75 years out, and we're going to add that to the supposed debt of the United States, when in fact it's a separate budget, and it's funded by people who are going to work over the next 75 years. So you can't include that Social Security debt that you're projecting. And also, if we our trillion-dollar debt doesn't really mean much if we are operating at, you know, in the case of you know, to bring it back down to Detroit, if our operating budget isn't off kilter. Now, the analogy can go too far, because, like I say, on a national level we can print our own currency, but in the context of Detroit, that's what's important to understand.
No, I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, and you know, you mentioned the 75-year like requirements on Social Security. I mean, a similar thing that comes to mind at the federal level is they've created this requirement that the Postal Service needs to pre-fund its pension liabilities for the next 75 years, and that's a burden that no other employer has to meet. No private sector employer, no public sector employer, and it's entirely done to create this crisis to try to privatize the post office.
Indeed. And so so we're back to Detroit. The $18 billion is sort of an irrelevant figure, but it's big, so it's scary. The $198 million sort of operating deficit they had, which sort of provided the justification for going into bankruptcy. Why was that 198? How could that have been met?
There's many ways you could have met that. One of the things that actually most immediately triggered the bankruptcy or triggered the crisis in Detroit was that state revenue sharing to the city declined precipitously in 2011. So in Michigan, as in many states, sales tax is collected locally, but it's sent to the state, and the state divvies it up amongst the different cities and municipalities. And so after the Tea Party election in 2010, when you had Governor Rick Snyder come in and a legislature that was overwhelmingly Republican, they slashed revenue sharing with the city by $67 million.
Wow.
There's a portion of that was based on the decline of the population, but actually the overwhelming majority of that $67 million was a discretionary cut that they made to basically create a revenue crisis in the city. On top of that, there were a couple of other things they had done. One, the state had previously limited the city's ability to raise any additional taxes locally. And then the other thing, and this was a pretty big one, is that they refused to empower the city to collect income taxes that was already due. And so the city of Detroit has a city income tax, and everyone who lives in Detroit is supposed to pay it. But if you live in the city but work in the suburbs, the city is not allowed to deduct the taxes from your payroll, and it relies on reverse commuters to voluntarily pay those taxes.
That's stunning.
It makes no sense. And a study by the mayor's office back in 2009 found that this actually cost the city $142 million.
Wow. So there's your operating deficit right there between just those two things as it is, which, again, like you say, is not to diminish the relevance of some structural problems with the city of Detroit. But if the money, those two things in and of themselves are pretty easy paths to getting the money. So this starving of Detroit of revenues that are clearly due them, where's the value in forcing to someone like Snyder? Where's the value in forcing Detroit into bankruptcy?
I mean, there's a couple of issues there. One is that if you look at Snyder, I mean, he was elected a Republican governor in an otherwise blue state, at the federal level anyway. And if you look at that state, the Democratic base of power really is the city of Detroit, which is also, it's 90% African-American. And in Michigan, it's actually, which the rest of the state is overwhelmingly white, that includes both the suburbs and other parts of the state, it's very popular to hate on Detroit. It plays very well politically, and Snyder doesn't have any votes, that he's not counting many votes from Detroit anyway, and so he doesn't lose much by sticking to them. But it does sort of, I mean, there is a long history of racial tensions in Detroit that is very much at play here. And that includes sort of, there's notions that people in other parts of the state have that the city of Detroit drags down Michigan, that Detroit, the people of Detroit are mooching on Michigan. And so to actually say that you're taking a tough line with Detroit, it plays very well politically. The other thing is that this is part of, the broader austerity agenda that we're seeing in this country, which is to create a government that's responsive to the needs of the 1%, because that's who provides the majority of campaign contributions, right? So that means low taxes for those at the top. It means slashing the social safety net because the rich don't think they need it and view it as an unnecessary cost, slashing pensions because that's seen as wasteful spending.
Pensions of public sector employees and unions.
Exactly. Slashing public sector employee pensions. And it also means you're privatizing whatever you can, right? Their agenda really is to make a profit off of public services by privatizing them. And with the other thing that that happened to do is it also allows corporations to assert greater control over public decision making. And so I think the reality is that what we're sort of seeing more generally, and this is also now what we're seeing in Illinois and other parts of the country, is that you have this corporatist agenda that it was already sort of, you know, already in play for a long time, but it's really sort of has sped up since Citizens United, which really is aimed at creating these crises so you can push a strict austerity agenda and really try to use that to gain, to get people to view it as an inevitability. Basically, you sort of say, that, look, we're looking at financial Armageddon, and we have no choice but to cut all of these things. And if you sort of say that loudly enough and say enough scary things about how your city is going to go bankrupt, then people start thinking, okay, well, maybe we have no choice but to accept these cuts. But, of course, what that does is it lets the wealthy and big corporations off the hook to pay their fair share in taxes, because whenever we're talking about an austerity agenda, we're basically pitting poor people against each other to leave them to fight over services, but we're not talking about bringing new revenue.
And thus, we move to Chicago. Chicago is, as you write, not an obvious choice for going into bankruptcy. Why do we hear any talk of Chicago going into bankruptcy? And I guess we'll ultimately get to the question now that Rahm Emanuel is has been reelected mayor. Will we hear any more after that?
So Chicago does have real financial issues. The reality is that Chicago's credit rating was just recently downgraded by Moody's down to junk level. So was the credit rating of Chicago Public Schools. And I would severely disagree with both of those ratings, because the reality is that there's a lot of problems with the credit rating system, and municipalities default at a rate of less than 0.01%. And so there's a lot of issues why those things are not why that's overblown, but that's one of the biggest reasons why we now are hearing about Chicago as the next Detroit, is because its credit rating is now down to junk, which makes it the second lowest credit rating of any major city in the country, second only to Detroit. But the other thing was that during the mayoral election, and actually also during the gubernatorial election last fall, Governor Rauner, and both of them have, both of them explicitly invoke bankruptcy to try to say that if you vote for the other guy, well, we might go bankrupt. And so there has been, as in Detroit, this sort of element of fear mongering to try to convince people that, well, if you don't elect the guy who's going to make the difficult choices, that, well, you might end up in bankruptcy and you might be the next Detroit. And so we had, one of Governor Rauner's earliest campaign ads back in the fall of 2013 explicitly invoked bankruptcy and said, well, if we don't change course, we'll be the next Detroit, the state of Illinois would, which is interesting because it was a bald-faced lie. States actually can't file bankruptcy. So the chances of the state of Illinois being the next Detroit does not exist. Similarly, in Chicago, where again, you had Mayor Emanuel sort of on several occasions raise the specter of Detroit. Senator Mark Kirk from Illinois, he explicitly said that if Rahm loses, then Chicago will be the next Detroit. Again, Chicago actually can't file bankruptcy under Illinois state law. Illinois does not allow municipalities to file bankruptcy.
So, aside from it being used as a political scare tactic, it seems to me that there's also at least still floating around there the idea that municipal bankruptcy could be a great way to attack public sector unions, right, which is the last sort of vestige of vibrant unionism in this country, because this is the best way to go about. I mean, theoretically, right, the Detroit was not allowed to cut its pensions because of state law. Isn't that right? But they found a way around that.
No, that's exactly right. So both Michigan and Illinois the state constitutions protect public sector pensions. You cannot impair public sector pensions under either state's constitution. And so one of the precedents that came out of the Detroit bankruptcy is this ruling by a judge that Chapter 9, which is, you know, part of the federal bankruptcy code, trumps state constitutions, and that even though state even though pensions are protected under state constitutions, the cities can use Chapter 9 to get around that. And so there is now a bill in the Illinois legislature to allow municipalities to file bankruptcy, and it's championed by the governor as well as you know, a couple of representatives from Chicago suburbs, the mayor of Rockford, Illinois. And they're very explicit that they want to do this so that cities can use bankruptcy to get out of their labor contracts and to get out of their pensions. And it's really alarming because they don't even try to hide it. It's sort of very, very, you know, nakedly open agenda. And, I mean, it is sort of, as you mentioned, very much part of the sort of broader attack on unions. Governor Rauner has, since coming in, he's explicitly said that if he has his way, there will be no more unions in the state of Illinois in the next 4 years, which, I mean, it's interesting because the reality is that he's, you know, like Governor Snyder, actually more so than Governor Snyder, he was elected in a – Rauner was elected as a Republican governor in a deeply blue state, and he was elected because, you know, his predecessor, Pat Quinn, was deeply unpopular for a variety of reasons. But Illinoisans very much voted against Quinn. They didn't vote for Rauner. They voted against Quinn. And Rauner basically is really trying to weaken the Democratic Party's power over the course of the next 4 years. And he understands that attacking unions will go a long way towards doing that. And so this he's been advocating this turnaround agenda, which he's been shopping around the state, which includes, among other things, the municipal bankruptcy, but also creating, you know, right-to-work or free rider zones, and a variety of other things. So far, the legislature has repeatedly rejected every aspect of his turnaround agenda, and it has yet to go anywhere. But it's clear that there is sort of this broader thing that he's trying to do, sort of change the face of Illinois in the next 4 years.
Well, this is sort of the Scott Walker game plan, right? I mean, they know, a Republican governor knows that their election, their re-elections happen, at least in this instance, and in many states, frankly, in the off year of elections, which now structurally we know favors Republicans on a sort of consistent basis. The opposite is true for Democrats in terms of presidential elections. And so they are now sort of applying a more hardcore base strategy, and by also not just from a political standpoint, but from a strictly sort of a electoral and sort of a tactical standpoint, trying to kneecap, as it were, classic Democratic, I guess, or left-leaning constituencies and institutions by you attack unions, you attack in this instance. And so this is sort of part of the game plan, I guess.
No, that's exactly right. And the other thing that really can't be overstated is the importance of Governor Rauner's background. I mean, he was a private equity firm manager before he was governor. He actually has not been in public government before this. And the reason why that's important is that what he's doing is very much applying the private equity business model of slash and burn to the state. Right? The private equity model is that you buy up a company, you extract all the value that you can, you slash and burn the company, you cut corners wherever you can to extract value to enrich those at the top. And that's really the approach that Rauner's applying to the state, where he's proposing deep draconian cuts. He's trying to cut his budget proposal would cut state aid to municipalities by 50%. It would cut education by over 30%. And, you know, various at the same time that he's, you know, pushing tax cuts, sort of, you know, he's inherited a state that already had revenue issues, and his solution to that has been cut even more, already cut taxes even more, and then sort of say, well, we have no choice but to make these deep cuts to state aid and various other things. And then after sort of inflicting this pain on different cities by saying, we'll cut your state aid by half, he then says, and what you can do to solve the problem is file bankruptcy.
And we should say, there's two reasons why this story is relevant in places outside of Chicago and outside of Illinois. One is, it really is a similar dynamic we see on a national level. The pressures aren't as great, again, because as a national government, carrying debt is much easier, and you also have the ability to print your currency. But and then on a non-national level, this is something that we're going to see, I think, more and more over the course of the next the next decade, in the event that these type of people get into office. So let's just take it to what you talk about a playbook in pushing back. How do we do that?
Yeah, the thing that we really need is we need more structural revenue solutions. The reality is that the biggest reason why the Detroit playbook works, and again, the Detroit playbook is this idea that you create these crises to then force people to accept unconscionable cuts. The reason why it works is because we accept their paradigm that we're broke, that our cities are broke. The reality is our city governments are broke, but our cities aren't broke. The cities actually, I mean, Detroit being an exception here, where Detroit really, there was not much wealth in Detroit, but the state of Michigan was not broke, and the city of Chicago is not broke. There's actually a whole lot of wealth in Chicago. It's just not properly taxed.
And even in Detroit, like you mentioned, there were receipts due. It's just that the money was coming into the city and then leaving at night, and the city had no legal authority in which to collect those taxes.
Right. And the other piece that's also true in Detroit is it also had a lot of corporate tax breaks that it was giving. One of the things that was interesting is that when they talk about, restructuring the city's debt and making pensioners take a haircut, the thing they don't look at is, well, how about clawing back some of those corporate tax breaks that we're giving to companies that, literally move from the suburbs into the city in order to get a tax break?
But Saqib, that would be going back on a contract. You can't do that.
Right. And of course, you can't go on back on a contract unless it's a union contract.
Right.
But now what we need is we need progressive revenue solutions. And so what that means is, we need a millionaire's tax. We need to claw back corporate tax breaks, especially for corporations that didn't deliver on the jobs or the economic output that they promised. We also need to claw back money from bad financial deals. The reality is that in both Detroit and in Chicago, and actually in a lot of other places, you have city officials that have been saddled with predatory financial deals in much the same way that banks sold predatory mortgages to homeowners that were low on cash. They did very much the same thing to cities and states. They sold them deals that were highly risky, had hidden costs, were overly complex, designed to fail. And a lot of these deals really blew up and backfired, especially after the financial crash. And in the case of Detroit, the city actually ended up losing between had to pay, I believe, they're on the hook for as much as about $500 million between payments that they actually made post-crisis and then payments that the banks were demanding before the bankruptcy. That amount was brought down a bit through the bankruptcy process, but that was actually a huge figure that really hurt the city. And that's also a big deal in Chicago, where now that the city's credit rating has been cut down to junk, the city, as a result of that downgrade, now owes about $2.2 billion in payments to various banks and investors. And
people should understand that dynamic, that once your credit rating falls below a certain point, you're on the hook to pay people back quicker or more immediately. I mean, that's to a large extent what happened with parts of the financial crisis, right? When the sort of the derivatives kick in when certain things lose their value.
Absolutely. And it's one of those things where in a lot of these cases, the penalties that you have to pay are, it's they call it the fair value of a deal, which what that actually means, depending on the deal, but in a lot of cases what it means is that you have to pay the bank all the future profits on the deal right now. So in the case of interest rate swaps, which is a very common type of derivative that backfired, again, both Detroit, Chicago, other parts of the country, these deals have proved really toxic. With interest rate swaps, if termination is triggered on this, you have to pay the banks all of their profits 30 years worth right now.
Hmm.
And the only way to do that is by borrowing more money. Well, if you borrow money once your credit rating has been lowered, it's like trying to take out a new loan right after your credit score gets lowered. You pay a much higher interest rate for it. And so it basically forces you to borrow more money at exactly the time that that borrowing will be as expensive as it ever can be. And so it's really a problematic. And so one of the things that we're really doing to be looking at is, you know, how do we actually start renegotiating these predatory deals or taking legal action to get out of them before there's a crisis situation, so that we're not faced with these huge payments that we can't deal with.
Zach Abadi, director of Refund America, fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. It's a fascinating piece, and it's, I think, an issue that is going to become more and more prominent in cities across the country, frankly. I appreciate your time today to walk us through this.
Thank you.
Might take some time, might take some medication. How can I trust the right name into the conversation?